welcome to another episode of Populous. I'm Steve Hafer, and the yin to my yang is Kurt Trittner, and he's sitting here right with us. Hello, Kirk.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 14. This episode's top 10 will be all about best Disney movie songs. Now, we got to be clear. That's a pretty big path if you're going with Pixar and Touchstone and all the other variants. So, nope, these are just Disney movies that we're going to be talking about today. And even then, Steve, I thought there were way too many songs to choose from. This was a lot of fun doing the research, as it always is. But I think this list is going to be our most varied list yet.
Yeah, it definitely has that possibility. And I remember pitching to you that we cut Pixar and Touchstone because I was already starting to feel overwhelmed. Then I thought, oh, God, this will be so much easier. No. I could have done a top 25 for this and still had difficulties selecting who was going to be in it. There was a lot of material.
Absolutely.
And a lot of great material. And it almost feels like a crime that things that are being off the list, it's like, wow, they are definitely deserving. And I think people will hear us say a lot that almost made my list. We'll try not to do that too much, but... before we start off, I just want to give a special shout out and much thanks to some of our amazing listeners who became donors to the show recently. We appreciate it tremendously. You sure helped make the show go. Just check out our donors page the list of honor, because those names are on there now, which you have all been placed. And Kirk and I really appreciate it, and we applaud you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you all very, very much. You know who you are.
But back to this week, did you use a certain criteria?
I used several, and that's what made it hard. We were talking about this before we started taping, is that part of the challenge I had was, how did I want to frame the list? How did I want to define that list? What was the objective way of doing this? And I went with so many ideas, and with that, the songs rearranged, songs shifted places, some songs dropped off, some songs were added. And, you know, as we always say, if we did this show tomorrow, this list could be completely different. But as of today, I think I've got a pretty solid list. And to me, it's not only the best songs, but it's what best represents Disney as well.
Yeah, that's a great point. And that's no joke about rearranging if we did this tomorrow. Last night, three songs left my list. Three new ones came on. There was, especially for that bottom six of the list, it always seems to hover and get a range. I'm usually pretty confident with my top three, top four, top five and most lists. This one, I was only really confident about the top five, knowing that they'd be on the list somewhere. But even with the exception of number one, I wasn't sure where things were going to seed. I kind of used the criteria of what is important, or which song was important in advancing that Disney feel and the Disney image, that overall scope of what Disney is. Also the importance in advancing the story of the film that the song is in, and identifying, you know, a big character moment or description of what's going on in the movie. And just also what is just a really good superior piece of music. So that, you know, it's kind of tough to take the blend, but Disney does a great job doing it. As we mentioned, when you and I were talking, so many great composers, and you know, the modern era was kicked off by Menken and Ashman, the team of, and then followed by guys like Phil Collins, and more recently Lin-Manuel Miranda. Some really good big names in there, so it'll be interesting to see what we have. But let's talk about our unlisted songs.
You know, just piggybacking on what you were saying about criteria, you know, one of the quotes I pulled from Walt himself was, we should set a new pattern, a new way to use music, weave it into the story so somebody just doesn't burst into song, which was kind of revolutionary back in the 30s. You know, the whole idea of using the music to advance the story. So I think that's an important part of how we all went about it. But getting to the unlisted part, you know, we talked about this beforehand. This is where I start encouraging people to write cards and letters. Three of the songs you will not hear on my list are Hi Ho from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. The music written by Paul Dukas for The Sorcerer's Apprentice, the Mickey Mouse segment of Fantasia. And you will not hear Let It Go on my list. I think there are stronger songs, and quite frankly, I liked it better when it was Defying Gravity in Wicked.
You and I are going to have issues here.
But you don't have a daughter.
Maybe an imaginary. No. I have a puppy.
Well, telling a puppy to let it go has entirely different meanings.
Yeah. Very true. You know, even if each Disney film only had one hit song, that would be tough. But so many of them are just loaded with multiple hits. You know, Mary Poppins, Jungle Book, Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast, Little Mermaid, Lion King, Hercules, Frozen. They all have multiple songs. And so, and all good songs, too. So it was really hard. But some of the songs that won't be on my list also include Hi Ho from Snow White. And Oscar winners, Can You Feel the Love Tonight? From The Lion King, and the title song from Beauty and the Beast, Beauty and the Beast, sung by the always popular and one of my personal favorites, Angela Lansbury.
So our unlisted lists match up. And I made the prediction before we went on that this was going to be our most varied list. I'm setting the over under on songs that we have common on the list, not the same place, but just common songs on the list. I'm setting the over under at 2.5.
Common songs. Wow. Okay. I'll take the over on that, because even though I know what you're saying, you and I just have this, we have this uncanny ability to match up more than we think we're going to sometimes. So, I'll even set the number at,
you can take the over. Okay.
Yeah. I'll set the number at 5. I think we're going to actually have 5 that match, but just probably way different seedings.
Interesting.
But anyway, we get to find that out with you as you start us off.
Number 10.
So my number 10, and just one other thing, I chose only one song from a movie. So I wanted to spread the wealth a little bit. So my number 10 goes back to 1950. It is A Dream is a Wish Your Heart Makes from Cinderella, written by Mac David, Al Hoffman, and Jerry Livingston, performed by Lean Woods. This is the song that kicked off the movie. It's where Cinderella encourages her friends in the forest to never stop dreaming. That theme continues through the film. And honestly, is there anything more Disney than dreams coming true? So I thought this was the perfect song to start the list. It's an iconic song. It's one that is beloved in the Disney canon. To me, it is very representative of what Disney is and strives to be and the image that's out there. So A Dream is a Wish Your Heart Makes from Cinderella is my number 10.
Good choice. Yeah, I struggled long and hard with that one. It is not on my list, but it is one of the classic Disney themes. That song, along with two others of the original old time princess, quote unquote, songs, are those things that they pipe in when you're walking through the castle, entering Fantasyland. You know, they are those Disney staples. That is definitely a strong choice. My number 10 is one of the more fun or hard titles to say, and that is Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious from Mary Poppins in 1964, written by the Sherman brothers, Richard and Robert Sherman, who were Disney's go-to guys for writing music back in the day. Well, I'm sure we will hear about their names in reference at least a couple more times today. It's performed by Julie Andrews and Dick Van Dyke, two of my all-time favorite performers and personalities. And they are there with an animated Pearly band, a Cockney Pearly band, which is fun. It's live actors performing with animated actors. Julie Andrews even tells people that the word is, it's something to say when you have nothing to say. I've always kind of liked that definition. It's fast. It's fun. It kind of became an obsession with kids and family, you know, parents to say it and then try to say it backwards as Mary did in the movie. It's just one of those iconic songs. When you hear it, you know right where it comes from. There was a story in 2017, Dick Van Dyke was going to win a BAFTA award over in Britain. And he apologized to them ahead of time because he was going to have to do his acceptance speech. And he apologized for perhaps having the worst Cockney accent in the history of cinema in Mary Poppins. And BAFTA replied, well, that's okay. And we look forward to your acceptance speech in whatever accent you choose. No doubt it will be supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, which I thought was a cute reply and very appropriate. So that's my number 10.
I, in fact, have nothing to say because I'll be talking about supercalifragilisticexpialidocious a little bit later on in my list.
Aha, there's one on our list.
There's one.
What is your number 9?
Number 9.
Number 9 is from the 1953 film Peter Pan. And I think a lot of people would probably jump immediately to We Can Fly. But my choice is Second Star to the Right. It was written by Sammy Kahn and Sammy Fain, performed by the Judd Conlon Chorus. And that's one of the things that I think that really makes it unique, is that this is the only song on the list, I believe, that is sung by a chorus, not an individual or a duo, which gives this a real ethereal quality, which served perfectly in the film as the kids' entree into Neverland. It's a textbook example of the really simply sweet songs that Disney does so well. It's a little bit of hope, a little bit of wonder, a little bit of magic, and it just is right down Broadway when it comes to what a Disney song should be. In fairness, I only heard the film version of this maybe a few years ago. I first became aware of the song when James Taylor did it for the compilation album Stay Awake, and his treatment of it, turning it into almost a lullaby, really drew me to the song. And then when I heard the soundtrack version, it brought up all of those kind of Disney-esque feelings, that sense of wonder and magic and hope. So it's always been a favorite song of mine. I think it's a terrific tune. So Second Star to the Right from Peter Pan is my number nine.
Yeah, I too think it's a superior song to You Can Fly, You Can Fly, which is a great song, don't get me wrong, but Second Star to the Right is the heart and soul of Peter Pan and its theme. James Taylor really had an album called Stay Awake? That's a risky choice.
No. There was a compilation album called Stay Awake, where a whole bunch of people did Disney songs, and his song was Stay Awake.
I just can't imagine any record producer worth his salt saying, yeah, go ahead with name your album Stay Awake. That should sell really well. Well, my number nine is it's the first of the Disney princess songs on my list, and it's the movie itself I'm indifferent about. It's a good film. I can take it or leave it, and that's Colors of the Wind from Pocahontas, 1995. It's an Oscar winner, and it's sung by a four-time Tony nominee in Judy Kuhn, and she does a great job with it. It's definitely thematic of the movie. It's telling the whole story of setting the scene of what's the difference between the English explorers and the Native Americans, as Pocahontas shows John Smith the value of the earth and its living things. He learns to see things differently and starts to fall in love with her at the same time. It's a beautifully animated scene, beautiful song, starts slow with more of a tribal feel, and then builds almost as if all the elements of nature are building together in themselves. And I like it when the scene itself and the song are just so beautifully woven together. Beautiful song, song with a lot of power. Well done, Colors of the Wind.
Colors of the Wind did not make my list. I do think it is a good song. For me, it's a bit on the nose. If you go and just read the lyrics separately, it's a very, to me, they really worked to get these lyrics to work. And it's just a little too on the nose for me. There are other songs I like better. Don't get me wrong, again, good song, fun song, fit the movie very well. And like a lot of the songs I think are on both of our lists, I think these songs move the movie forward. They serve a purpose. It's not just, hey, let's put a number here for the sake of putting a number. These songs move the story along. Second Star to the Right was about the travel to Neverland. You know, Colors of the Wind, as you just said, really illustrated the lessons that Pocahontas wanted to teach. So, it is a good song. It's a perfectly Disney song. Just didn't make my list.
Okay. Well, what is on your list for the next slot?
Number eight.
My number eight could be the happiest song ever recorded for a Disney animated film. It was performed by Phil Harris and Bruce Reitherman, and it is The Bare Necessities from The Jungle Book in 1967. It was written by Terry Gilkison. I hope I'm getting that last name right. And it is the only song in the film not written by the Sherman Brothers, mm-hmm. who you mentioned a little bit earlier. But interestingly enough, they kept the song. The song was kept at their request from an earlier version of the film that had been planned 2 or 3 years ahead of time. So not only could they write good music, they recognized good music. And they knew that this is a really fun, strong tune for Jungle Book. The Phil Harris version is terrific. The Bill Murray version, from just a few years ago is also a lot of fun. It was nominated for a Best Song Oscar. And again, in staying with the idea that it moves the story along or helps feed the story, it just taught the lesson of simple pleasures. And it was just a really cute, fun way of doing it in this movie. I think it represented the era, the late 60s, really well. So The Bare Necessities from Jungle Book is my number 8.
Great song. My favorite song from one of my, still to this day, one of my favorite Disney films. Love that song. My number 8 is, it's animated, but it's a production number, and it's a great production number. And it is Be Our Guest from Beauty and the Beast from 1991. Also an Oscar nominee, and lost out to the title song, Beauty and the Beast, that year. It's performed by Jerry Orbach, who a lot of people know from crime dramas and stuff like that on television. But he was an old Broadway guy, starting 42nd Street and many, many other, The Fantastics, many famous plays. He's Lumiere, and then Angela Lansbury, who we mentioned before, is Mrs. Potts. It is a big production number. It's performed by the castle's enchanted staff to brighten the spirits of the newly captive Belle, and against the strict orders of their boss, the Beast. It's big, it's fun, it's layered, and it just builds. It's kind of shot like an old Hollywood or Broadway musical, show-stopping number. It's charming, memorable, and you see it and you hear it all over the place still. And once it gets inside your head, it can stick there. It's a great, catchy tune. It's a wonderful visual. It's very effective for the movie, and I've always loved it. Be Our Guest, my number 8.
Were you reading my notes? Because you said almost exactly everything I was going to say about that film, but just a little bit later on. It's a little higher on my list. I've got a few more things to add, but I couldn't agree more. You know, the whole Broadway feel that a lot of these, you know, Renaissance era animations from Disney took on, this really had that to it. And I'll talk a little bit more about that when I get to it. A little higher on my list.
Perfect. But what is next on your list?
Number 7.
My number 7 is a song that has defined the last 80 years for Disney in a lot of ways, and that is Someday My Prince Will Come from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs from 1938, written by Frank Churchill and Larry Morey, performed by a teenage Adriana Casalotti. Legend has it that Walt was actually on the phone to her father lamenting the fact he couldn't find a singer that sounded like a teenage girl, that the daughter grabbed the phone, this Adriana grabbed the phone, spoke to Walt, and that was her audition. She ended up getting the job and singing the role. AFI called this the 19th greatest song in film history. As I mentioned before, it set the stage for generations of songs and movies and, you know, ancillarily theme parks and ice shows and stage shows to come. And it's one of the first examples of what is called the I Want songs in Disney films. And that's not a pejorative definition. It's these songs that allow the characters to say, this is what I want, and sets the stage for what's to come in the movie. And it is an absolute definition of an I want. I want my prince to arrive so I can be with him and start my happy life. It's a beautiful song. It really captured the tone of 1938 in this movie very well. I think Disney has reaped the rewards of it for years. And it's just a terrific song, and you can't hear it without picturing yourself in the park or, as you mentioned before, walking through the castle. So number 7, Someday My Prince Will Come.
Yeah, it definitely is another one of those songs that you hear walking through the castle. It's of the 2 or 3 regular ones. Great song. And this song right here is one of the 3 that I mentioned was on my list as of last night and just got moved off. So I think highly of it. The actress, the young actress you're talking about, she lived in Larchmont Village in Los Angeles for years and years. And she had a wishing well out in front of her house that just was there for decades. And so she had always loved her experience, kept the identification with the character, and had a little wishing well in her yard. And people that passed by may not have known, but if you did know the story, then you went, ah, there it is. There she is. It's great.
That's very cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And if you're going to have one or just a couple of roles, being Snow White's not a bad one to put on your resume.
Yeah. Number 1 in the resume is a teenager, Snow White in Walt Disney's classic. Yep. Not bad. My number 7, this, we laugh about this at home because my son was taking an interest, my youngest son, in this list a little bit because he grew up with the newer genre of Disney songs. And he was really pitching the song Shiny from Moana to me. And it's like, it's the villain crab sings it. And, you know, if you're going to have a song sung by a crab, it's not that one. It's got to be Under the Sea from The Little Mermaid, 1989. An Oscar winner, sung by Samuel E. Wright as Sebastian the Crab, written by Menken and Ashman, as we talked about before. It's where Sebastian is explaining to Ariel, because she just got done with her want song, her wish song, and he's explaining to her how she really has it great by living in the ocean. She doesn't need to go live in the land of the humans on land. She has a wonderful current life. She doesn't need more. And it too, like Be Our Guest, is another big production number. And to be quite honest, I really could have switched either Be Our Guest or Under the Sea on either of these two spots. I love them both, and they're done in a similar style, big production number, and it's really well. This one starts, it's got a calypso and kind of reggae style, and it just keeps growing and growing. Undeniably catchy melody. The film is filled with wonderful songs, and I think this is one of the best. Under the Sea, Little Mermaid.
And so far, you are correct on the over-under prediction, because I will talk about Under the Sea a little bit later on, as it's a little higher on my list.
Well, by my count, we are at 4 matches already, and that's because I haven't told you about one of them. Here we go. Let's move on. What's your number 6?
Number 6.
Number 6 begins a section of my list that really delves into, again, that this era that's called the Renaissance of Disney animation, starting with The Little Mermaid in 1989, and then just hit after hit after hit. And the common thread with these films was Alan Menken. And the song I put at number 6 is A Whole New World from Aladdin, 1992, written by Alan Menken and Tim Rice. This was the third consecutive Oscar for Menken for Best Original Song. He won it 3 out of 4 years. The single went to number 1. That was by Peebo Bryson and Regina Bell. The movie version was Brad Kane and Lea Salonga. And it really is just a wonderful duet. It won the Best Song Oscar and the Best Song Grammy in the same year. I think it's the only time that Disney's ever done that. And it's also unique in the fact that as it does set the stage, we talked a little bit about that. It's got that big production number feel as we get into these movies that do have more of a Broadway feel to them. But it also does double duty as both the movie's theme song and as the love song. So it really fits it fits in two slots very nicely, and really is a great table setter for the film. And one could also argue too, it's probably launched more karaoke duets than Summer Lovin'. So, it's got that place in the Karaoke Hall of Fame as well. I'm not crazy about Aladdin as a film overall, but there's some great music in it. Obviously the Robin Williams song, and Whole New World, great tunes.
The Robin Williams songs. He's got a couple great ones in Friend Like Me and Prince Ali.
Friend Like Me. That's the song I was trying to think of. But Whole New World just to me was the showpiece song in this movie. It deserved to be on the list. And so it's there at number 6 for me.
This is one of the other trio of songs that was on my list as of last night and went off. It is a great song. I think your karaoke mention, it plays a little bit in me taking it off the list, that I think I'm just maybe getting a little tired of it, which then tells me that maybe its legs aren't as strong as a couple other things that I did put on my list, but very worthy. And if we ever go back and do, you know, one of our revisiting our list, it may be the thing that I say, yeah, I should have kept it on. I don't know. It's a great song, but it will not be appearing on my list. My number 6 is the second appearance of a Mary Poppins song, written by, once again, the Sherman Brothers, and that is Chim Chim Cherie, an Oscar winner, performed again by Dick Van Dyke, who takes more of the lead in this one, and Julie Andrews as well, where she sang Supercalifragilistic, or most of it. He takes the big lead on this. This song was inspired by one of the drawings created by the film screenwriter, Don DeGrady, and the Sherman Brothers took an interest to it, and he explained the folklore attributed to the whole chimney sweep thing in England, and how shaking hands with a chimney sweep could be considered good luck. So they were really taken by that, and they wanted to bring that folklore into it. And they came up with a beautiful, great song. It's kind of two songs almost. It starts with a standard version, which Bert sings to the children, but then it comes back a few times during the movie in little smaller snippets at different times as Bert just kind of sings to himself with new verses that are specific to the new parts of the plot that are unfolding. So it has a magical, mysterious quality to it. It is kind of the overriding theme music of Mary Poppins itself. And it's done really well. And I love it. Always have loved it. And that's my number six, Chim Chim Cherie.
You know, at the end of the day, we could do an episode on just the top 10 songs in Mary Poppins, to be quite honest.
Yeah, it's loaded.
There's the two that we've already mentioned. There's Feed the Birds. There's Spoonful of Sugar. I mean, the list goes on and on. Go Fly a Kite.
Yeah.
I mean, the list goes on and on. But I couldn't agree with you more. That Mary Poppins was one of the first movies I ever saw as a kid that I recollect. Mm-hmm. And the images of the chimney sweeps up on the rooftop, or Mary flying, you know, or the melancholy, bittersweet feeling of Feed the Birds have stuck with me for, you know, almost 60 years now. And it's all about the music. It was all about the music.
Yeah, and great.
So
dance.
I completely agree with your choices. I just, like I said, I wanted to spread the wealth a little bit more.
Yeah, there's Jolly Holiday, when she does that great dance with the animated penguins, which is fantastic. The chimney sweep dance comes off the song Step in Time, builds off of that, which is another fun song. Not a great song, but a fun song and a wonderful dance number. So, yeah, we could talk about that one forever. Great, great movie. Let's move on. We're getting into the top five. What is your number five?
Number five.
My number five is one of the songs that you mentioned a little earlier, and that is from Beauty and the Beast, Be Our Guest. All the things you talked about before, written by Alan Menken and Howard Ashman, performed by Jerry Orbach and Angela Lansbury. And it was, you know, again, in Broadway parlance, the show-stopping number. You know, the first thing I thought about when I saw the scene was, this feels like what a Busby Berkeley number would look like if it was animated. It even actually kind of calls back to a little bit of the avant-garde approach of Fantasia. It was reminiscent of that for me as well. It was unique. It had that magical feel to it. As you mentioned, it kind of sets the stage for all of the magic to be experienced in the Beast's castle. It's upbeat. It builds. It's a catchy tune. Again, Disney has now leveraged it across the parks and in a number of ways, in advertising and restaurants and all the different ways that they can. And you're still not tired of it. So to your point, it still has legs. It's just, you know, again, you can go down the list of songs from Beauty and the Beast, and there's so many of them. So, you know, Kirk, how did you leave off Belle? How did you leave off Beauty and the Beast? You know, how'd you leave off? How'd you leave off? How'd you leave off? But for me, Be Our Guest is the showstopper. It is the one song you hang your hat on from this movie. So Be Our Guest is my number five.
Yeah, it's a great song. One of the better songs from that movie. Beauty and the Beast, the title song, is fantastic, but it's simple. It's beautiful. There's nothing that really sets it apart. You know, it's setting this story of what we already know at this point. I can't criticize it, but I think other songs stand out better in that movie.
Agreed.
Good choice. My number five is the opening song for The Lion King, and that is The Circle of Life. Oscar nominated, did not win, surprisingly. Can You Feel the Love Tonight won the Oscar that year. Hakuna Matata was also nominated, but I would make the argument that The Circle of Life is the most important of the three. Written by Elton John and Tim Rice, who used to be paired up with Howard Menken. Sung by Carmen Twilley and Lebo M. It's a beautiful piece. It starts off with the native Zulu language vocals of the male vocalist and the choir. Then it goes into the main narrative vocals and melody sung by Carmen Twilley. It describes the whole theme of the entire movie while painting a picture of the balance of all of the living creatures in Africa and the harmony of how it works there. It's stirringly powerful and it's soulful. It's descriptive of its time and place, and it's entirely memorable. Probably should have won the Oscar that year, in my opinion. It's just a powerful song. There's another great video that people can look up, and it's the traveling cast of the Broadway show of The Lion King, and they're on a plane headed for, I believe, Australia, if memory serves, and they're just kind of stuck on the taxiway waiting for clearance to take off. So they start singing The Circle of Life in a cappella, and it's great. They're all sitting there toward the front of the plane and watching the reaction of the rest of the passengers. Like at first, like, what's happening? Is this guy singing in the native Zulu tongue? And then they all start joining in, and people are just mesmerized. It's really cool. It's worth another look. So that's my number five, Circle of Life.
And again, I will be talking about this song a little bit later on my list because you have it way too low. Way too low, my friend.
It jumped positions three times. it is great, but I like the four songs that I have above it better. But let's move on. We're into Mount Rushmore territory.
Number four.
All right, getting to my Mount Rushmore, my top four. Number four for me is, again, another song. Most of the songs I'm going to talk about now are ones you've already mentioned because they're in their proper locations here on Mount Rushmore, is from Mary Poppins, and it is Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. I was never so proud in all my life when I was a little boy when I finally pronounced that word. I worked on it for like a year and a half, and it just made me the proudest guy in the world. My mom looked at me and said, yep, you got it. It was awesome. Performed by Julie Andrews, as you mentioned, going back to the AFI top 100 list. They call it the 36th greatest song in film history. It, for me, it's a perfectly balanced song for the film, injecting a little bit of whimsy and a little bit of magic into the phrase and into everyday life. It really is a microcosm of the film in general. It's happy. It's joyful. You can't say the word without feeling a little bit better and putting a pep in your step. You can't think about that scene and the kids trying to keep up with her without putting a smile on your face. So for me, Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious really is Mary Poppins, you know, in a bottle. If you bottled Mary Poppins, that's what you'd get, is this song. So that's why it's at number four on my list. And that is Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. I did it, Mom.
Say it backwards. Can't do it, can you?
No, I cannot. I cannot.
Neither can I.
Thanks. Thanks for making me feel good about my accomplishment, Steve.
It's good to have those small term goals when you're a kid. You did very well, Kirk. Great, great song. Maybe a little too high, but good song. My number four is, again, from The Little Mermaid. No nominations for this, and I just don't know why, and it was Part of Your World. Written by Menken and Ashman, as we mentioned a few times, performed by Jodie Benson. Sometimes Disney songs, you know, they become hallmarks due to situation, spectacle, emotional content. This one is more of a poetic storytelling that hits a little emotional things, but it's just beautifully done, beautifully blended song. It's a great balance of spoken and sung lyrics, as Ariel tells us about her life's dream. As you mentioned before, it's one of those want songs, but it's more than that. Tons of sincerity and passion in this song. We feel her wants and wishes. We become totally invested and start pulling for her from that moment. She becomes us, we become her, and for the rest of the journey, we are there together. And it's really because of this song. It's beautifully crafted, it's beautifully drawn, and we just get what she's after. It's a poetic storytelling and great character development. Arguably the best of the Disney princess songs, in my estimation. It's not necessarily the most powerful, but it's just really well done and very well crafted. So that's my number four, Part of Your World by The Little Mermaid.
As you like to say, I'm going to pull a Steve and say that this song was actually on my list until I think this morning, when I swapped it for another song from Little Mermaid, which I just think is a tiny bit stronger. But you're right. It is terrific. It's all the things we've talked about. It sets the stage. It tells a story. It moves the plot along. It helps you go on the journey with Ariel because now you understand what she's going after. And it's just a great song as well. So I completely understand why you have it on there. I almost had it on there and quite high on my list. But it is not on my list. But my Little Mermaid song is next.
Ooh, what is it?
Number three.
You had mentioned it a little bit earlier. It is Under the Sea from Little Mermaid, 1989. Again, written by Alan Menken and Howard Ashman. And I don't think it can be understated how much importance this soundtrack had to the fortunes of Walt Disney, the Walt Disney Company, not just animation or films, for the past 30 years. The song won the Oscar, I believe, for Best Original Song, and it broke a 22-year dry spell between your song, Chim Chimney, and Under the Sea. There were 22 years, which I think everybody, especially Disney files, can agree were pretty fallow years for the animation group. There's even talk about shuttering animation or farming it out a little bit more. That, you know, this is what resulted in Oliver and Company and The Black Cauldron and you know, some films that aren't as memorable. But then you get this powerhouse soundtrack, Alan Menken, Howard Ashman. They bring this Broadway sensibility to these films that they're doing, and they just create these songs that tell stories, evoke imagery, serve the plot, and are entertaining all at once. And this was one of those songs. It is unbelievably infectious. Samuel Wright just did a terrific job. But I could have easily picked Kiss the Girl. I could have easily picked Part of Your World. Again, it's just a treasure trove of songs. But I went with Under the Sea. I think it really serves the movie wonderfully well. It is a little bit more memorable to me than Part of Your World. So that's why it's at my number three.
You know, I like it. It's a great song. I just had a little lower. You're talking about that dead period for Disney. It's funny because there were some movies that had at least one good, really good song that could have been nomination worthy or whatever. Oliver and Company had one. Fox and the Hound had one. Robin Hood had one. It's a little surprising that they didn't get any play during that time, but I think it's just because the movies didn't garner a lot of respect or attention themselves. Good choice. My number three is one that you mentioned earlier that you had way, 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 way too low. Most of the songs that we've been talking about are big, powerful numbers, whether they're the production numbers that we talk about or these big soaring solos of these want songs or the thematic heart of the movies. This song is none of that as far as the power of the spectacle. It is The Bare Necessities from The Jungle Book. As Kirk mentioned, Oscar nominated. And I love the fact that it's the one song that the Sherman Brothers did decide to keep. As you said, it shows their respect and their recognition for what is a good song. Phil Harris sings it. He plays Baloo the Bear. He was also Thomas O'Malley, the cat, the alley cat from the Aristocats. This song lost to Dr. Doolittle's Talk to the Animals. And in hindsight, you're going, wow, this song is so superior to that in my estimation. Talk to the Animals is a nice song, but it just doesn't hold up as well. One of the reasons I love this so much is The Jungle Book was Disney's first feature employing the technique of animating their characters with some of the physical characteristics of the voice actor. And that's what they did with Baloo the Bear. He has some of the facial structure characteristics of Phil Harris. It was also Walt Disney's last film. He passed away before the premiere, so he never got to see it. And part of the reason was, as you mentioned, there was an earlier version of the script that had to be retooled, new songs brought in, which delayed the process a little bit. It's a perfect character intro for Baloo the Bear, who's one of the three main characters of the movie. And it builds the story and the bond between him and Mowgli. And we know why Mowgli wants to stay in the jungle, doesn't want to be join the man village. It's beloved to this day. It's fun. It's easy, carefree, paints a picture of the good life that Mowgli could have in the jungle and that Baloo and Bagheera and the others do have in the jungle. It's charming, fun, contagious, great, great song. I think it's one of their very best. It's memorable. It is one of those Disney themes, The Bare Necessities.
Great choice. Way too high. The song's also a little too high.
No, it's not.
But again, you know, we could put all these songs on a piece of paper in a box, shake it up, pull them out, put them in that random order, and we'd be right. I mean, you can't go wrong with so many of these songs, but you apparently can.
Yeah, the importance of the song and the importance of The Jungle Book, what it meant to the style of Disney animation and the way they're proceeding is, it's important. It's big. Let's move on. What is your numero dos?
Number two.
My number two is the last of the songs you've already mentioned. It is The Circle of Life from The Lion King. I think it's unquestionably the opening sequence of Lion King is the most spectacular visual sequence, opening sequence of any Disney animated film. And this song more than matches the visual impact. Keep in mind, there's no dialogue in the beginning of this film. It is simply the images that we see and the song that is being played. And from that, we understand everything that's going to unfold for us for the next couple of hours. And I defy you to put the song on headphones, close your eyes, and not picture the red sunset, not picture everybody gathering at Pride Rock. It is, again, using that Broadway vernacular, it is that large opening moment. And if you've ever seen the Broadway play, they literally lift it, you know, movement by movement, note for note. I mean, it is the exact same thing. It is to me the greatest intersection of Broadway and animation, you know, on film. Again, Elton John, Tim Rice, top of their game. I also like the fact that it has transcended just the movie. The phrase "circle of life" is now part of our vernacular. It is something that lives on in more than just the song from this movie. It has greater meaning to people. And I think that's an important aspect of this film as well. And I also think it's wonderful that during the 2016 baseball season, Johannes Cespedes used this song as his walk-up song when he was with the Mets. So it can serve a number of purposes as well. So Circle of Life, powerful song, and it is my number two.
Cespedes should have used "I Can't Hit the Circle Change" for you baseball fans out there.
You trying to tell me that Jesus Christ can't hit a curveball?
Whoops, we just regressed back to episode one.
That's the circle of life.
Ooh, point well made.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, this was part of my restructuring of numbers 2, 3, 4, and 5 on my list last night. They were bouncing all over the place. There was probably 11 different versions of "That's Mathematically Possible." Good movie. Hard to argue with what you said. I love the thing that I read about Tim Rice, who was known and made his name working with Andrew Lloyd Webber on Jesus Christ Superstar and many other big projects for Broadway. And Tim Rice was blown away about how fast Elton John composes music. That Rice would come up with these wonderful lyrics and he would hand,
I read that too.
Yeah, he'd hand them over and he'd expect that he would mold them over and then start bending and shaping things. And then he said, literally within a few days, boom, there it was. He's like, wow. So yeah, great, great pairing between those two. Okay. My number two is, it's a song that Kirk already mentioned is not on his list. And I'm just not quite sure why, because it is a great song. It's a powerful song. And that is from Frozen in 2013, the song "Let It Go," an Oscar winner, sung by Idina Menzel, a Tony winner. She played Elsa. It's kind of the new standard for the modern era of Disney music. It's a beautiful song. It just starts with a piano, almost like icicles and snowfall, and then it leads to one of the better builds of music from the Disney movies. It builds into that strong thing and takes the power of Idina Menzel's voice, which kind of is matching what's happening with Elsa as she's unleashing her power and starting to turn the world around her into her new frozen kingdom. It's amazing computer animation as we see her transform this this forest into her new residence, and it's beautifully done. It is a good piece of music. I know it's easy to make the connection with her from her days in Wicked. The separation between the two wasn't that big, and it's just because her voice is so recognizable and it's just that powerful and that strong and that good. As a song, it's built into its zenith. The song itself finishes just by closing off, just kind of the way that Elsa is closing herself off to the rest of the world. And launches us into the second half of the story. It is the bridge that takes us into the second half of the movie. It's an important song within the movie. It's a big song, musically sound, won the Oscar. That's my number two, "Let It Go."
I can't let it go. I'm having some fun, not
obviously
putting it on my list, but I agree with a lot of what you're saying. I just think the song is a little bit more lightweight and will not have the legs that some of the songs that we've talked about on the list already. I could be wrong. I could be very wrong, and it wouldn't surprise me if I'm wrong. I'm very good at being wrong, but it just, for me, it there's nothing about it that stands out. It's like a B average across the board. Yes, it serves the movie. Yes, it has a powerful voice. It just doesn't work for me.
Kirk. I think you will find, as time does go on, that it does have legs. I think we'll hold up just fine.
I don't know. We'll talk about it on our 20th anniversary show, and you'll go, Kirk, you were so right.
Yeah. So once again, let me talk to the viewers about our new viewer mail section. All right. Now we're at the point where we recap our 10 through 2s. My 10 through 2s started with Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious from Mary Poppins. Number 9 was Colors of the Wind from Pocahontas. Number 8 was Be Our Guest. Number 7, Under the Sea. Number 6, Chim Chim Cheree, also from Mary Poppins. Number 5 was The Lion King's The Circle of Life. Number 4, Little Mermaid's Part of Your World. Number 3, The Wonderful, The Awesome, The Bare Necessities from The Jungle Book. And number 2 was Let It Go from Frozen. Kirk, what about yours?
Starting with number 10, Cinderella's A Dream is a Wish Your Heart Makes. Number 9, The Second Star to the Right from Peter Pan. The Jungle Book's Bare Necessities was number 8. Someday My Prince Will Come from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs was number 7. Whole New World from Aladdin was number 6. Number 5, Be Our Guest from Beauty and the Beast. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, number 4. Under the Sea from Little Mermaid, number 3. Circle of Life from The Lion King is number 2.
Well, and by my count, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 matches on our lists, just not in the same spots.
Not in the same spots, and my guess is
we might have one more.
We're going to match number 1. Yeah.
So with the appropriate drum roll and fanfare, Kirk, what is your number 1?
Number 1.
Much like Barry Sanders in the Heisman discussion was the clear far and away winner, for me at least, the clear far and away best Disney song of all time is When You Wish Upon a Star from Pinocchio, 1940. Written by Lee Harlein and Ned Washington, it was performed by Cliff Edwards with his perfectly quavery voice as Jiminy Cricket. AFI called it the 7th greatest song in film history. It was the first Disney song to win an Oscar. These are the objective descriptions of it, but it has become something that embodies and defines the entire Disney experience. It has transcended the movie and has become part of the Great American Songbook. I read a quote that said it set the gold standard for Disney songs that transcended the reasons they were commissioned and in the context in which they should be heard. They grew larger than life. They grew bigger than the movies that they were in. My favorite, I'm going to leave some for you to talk about because I'm assuming that you have the same song.
Yeah, I certainly do.
Yep. So that puts us at 6 songs that we matched. But I thought it was really interesting that Brian Wilson said that this was the song that inspired him to write Little Surfer Girl. And if you think about it, little surfer, little one. And then when you wish upon, I mean, it's a lot of that same rhythmic and some of the same notes, you know, that builds into that. So I just thought that was really interesting and tells me that that's a song that over the generations continues to be relevant and important to musicians and to audiences as well.
Yeah, it is the Disney theme.
It is.
Cliff Edwards does a great job. He was one of Disney's favorite guys. He's in other Disney movies singing smaller parts in other films, but this is the one that he'll be known for. What I like about this song also, it serves as the bookends for the movie Pinocchio. We hear it over the opening credits and we hear it in the final scene. So it wraps up everything that the movie's about very nicely with the bookends, as Disney tends to do sometimes. When Disney does projects that are important to them, they use this song as their emotional connective theme. They want you to think Disney when you hear this song. And you do. It is their hallmark.
Well, let's be honest. They use this song for even things that are not that important.
They use it a lot.
It has become their corporate theme.
But you know, when they really want to make a point and they really want to say, this is Disney and what we're talking about here is important, this is their go-to.
Yes.
They use it in a lot of things. Like you said, they use it in fireworks. They use it in the Fantasmic show on TV specials. They do use it a lot, but I would say that they use it well. They don't overuse it to where it has become overly saturated in a weekend. It's a great song. Other performers have covered it, like Billy Joel, Linda Ronstadt, Beyonce, and Idina Menzel. So it's just one of those great pieces of music that other performers recognize and they love to sing it, much like Over the Rainbow and some other monumental great movie songs. So I can't argue with your choice because it's my choice too. It's When You Wish Upon a Star.
And it's also one of those songs that when you do hear it in the context where Disney uses it in other projects, when you do hear that, it's almost Pavlovian. You know you're going to get something that they think is important or that is going to be quality or that you're looking forward to. It's just that it gets you excited to see what's coming next after you hear it.
Exactly. Well, good list. We did have a few more that match, as I suspected we might, but we covered a lot of different generations and decades because that's what Disney does, and they've been strong and great for a long time. Let's move to Unlisted Part B. Now that we've reviewed our list, what are some of those honorable mentions, those ones that almost made your list?
Well, we mentioned a couple of them already. Chim Chim Cheree, Part of Your, if I was going to double up on certain movies, that was one way to go about it. There's a song called Baby Mine from Dumbo.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a 2-minute piece of music that is just so sweet and so beautiful, but it breaks your heart.
Yep.
I mean, it is one of the most difficult scenes to watch. And I shouldn't take anything away from the song because of that, but it does. You can watch it maybe once every 10 years. And each time you do, you go, oh, that's right. That's why I don't watch this, because it just breaks your heart. It is so sweet. It is so loving. It is so tender. And it may be one of those that I want to find a place for on the list next time around, because you talk about a film or a song that does exactly what it is supposed to in a Disney film. And it is Baby Mine.
Yeah. Baby Mine and Love Is a Song, the theme from Bambi, are two of those songs that are these emotional, rich, big connective tissue songs that, they were tough to leave off. We talked a little about Robin Williams' song, A Friend Like Me. That came very close for me. Just great character development, great story pusher. I also like Disney's occasional songs that they give to the villains themselves. And two of those are Poor Unfortunate Souls from Little Mermaid and Gaston from Beauty and the Beast. Both great, great songs. Be Prepared from The Lion King is another one that comes to mind. But they do this from time to time.
Cruella DeVille.
Yeah, which she doesn't sing, though. It's sung about her. It's about the villain. But they sometimes give the villain their song to move along their point of view. And they do it very well. The Gospel Truth from Hercules. I love this song. It's sung by the Muses. It's very much like the three backup singers in A Little Shop of Horrors, since this is another Menken production. But the harmonies are great. They tell the narrative, the story, and they're just really, really good singers, and it's really good music. So all those things almost made my list, along with A Whole New World and Zippity Doodah from Song of the South. Rick, that was on my list as of last night.
Yeah, that's a tough one to talk a little bit about, given the context of the film and such. And honestly, I think there are 10 better songs, the ones that I listed. But as we talked about at the top of the show, embarrassment of riches with this category. And that's why I thought we'd have more variety than we did. But I'm glad to see that we agreed on most. And we're going to work on that other one for you.
Yeah. And I look forward to seeing what the listeners say a little later on the show when we talk about the Populist.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that does it for us on the first half. We're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we'll have more fun for you. Be right back.
Okay, show of hands. Do you stick around for the credits at the end of a movie or a TV show? You might, but most folks don't. And even then, you might not be familiar with half the jobs on there. My name is Bruce Rand Berman. When I came out to LA a while back, I found there was a lot more to this industry than I realized. With the help of some great friends and mentors along the way, I've been able to chart my course to where I am today, an experienced television producer doing a podcast about all the different jobs there are in Hollywood and how to get them. So check out Call Time on your favorite podcast platform. You'll hear all about the industry straight from the mouths of the real people who work hard every day and night in the trenches on set and in the office. Yeah, this is my podcast, but it's your call time. Don't be late.
Hello. Wait, what? You haven't heard the new podcast, Mojo Girl Madness? Good news. Season one is now available for binging. Mojo Girl Madness is a mad pod with interviews, rants, and stories about sex, relationships, family, divorce, politics, showbiz, and mostly your mojo. Find Mojo Girl Madness wherever you get your pods or at mojogirlmadness.com. And now, back to the main event. Love you madly.
And we're back, and that means it's time for
the guest list.
And today, our special guest is Chris Ledesma. He is a music editor of film and TV. He attended the California Institute of the Arts as well as the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. He's edited many films, including Pure Country, Robin Hood, Men in Tights, as well as the Emmy Award-winning television show Gypsy, starring Bette Midler and War and Remembrance. Oh, yeah. And he also is the only music editor that the award-winning television show The Simpsons has ever known. That's over 32-plus seasons and over 700-plus episodes of consistent work, which is virtually unheard of in this business. He's composed the music for the episode Grampy, Can You Hear Me? And was nominated for a Golden Reel Award for his music editing on the episode Wild Bart's Can't Be Broken. He's even conducted the L.A. Philharmonic for part of the tribute concert honoring Simpsons composer Alf Clausen. He's an all-around good guy, very good at what he does, and perfect man to be our guest today. It is Chris Ledesma. Hey, Chris, welcome.
Hey, Steve, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Chris, it's good to see you again.
Kirk, hey, nice to see you after a number of years that since we've been together. We used to spend every day together, but not so much lately.
Yes, we did.
Sitting backwards and talking at people with blank stares.
That's right.
Oh, no, it's a shark. as we refer to, the good old days.
Yep.
So, Chris, as a music editor, you're very involved with the whole process between the composer, the director, the film editor, and yourself on how does that relationship work? What is the give and the take, the ins and the outs of that foursome?
Right. I'll try to make it, you know, quick and easy. One thing, right away, it's going to sound like a plug, but it'll help. I have a blog that I started years ago about working on The Simpsons, and there are pages that go into much more detail about exactly what my job is and music editing, and it goes through all the steps. So I'll talk about that a little bit later. But anyway, basically, it's this. When people ask me this, what often happens is they'll come up to me and they'll say, oh, you're the music editor on so-and-so, so you write the music for the show? And I immediately, nope, I'm not the composer. Although I do get to compose once in a while, but that's not my primary job. So my quick and easy answer is there are two people primarily in charge of getting the score off the ground and on the screen. That's the composer and the music editor. And in the simplest terms, the composer is the creative person, dreams it up, composes it, and realizes the music. And the music editor is the technical person. Make sure all of the technical I's are dotted and T's are crossed. Make sure that the music is in sync with the picture. Make sure that the music is properly placed in the picture where we wanted it to go. Make sure that it's properly balanced against the dialogue and the sound effects, that you hear the music when you want to hear it, and it gets out of the way when you don't want to have it stepping on dialogue or whatever. So my job is a technical job. The composer's job is the creative job. As far as my relationship with the various people, that all depends. My job is also kind of interesting. It's a little hard in our business, the business of show, to make any sort of long-term living, right? Because you just go from project to project to project. But the thing about this is like for example, a director. a studio or a producer will hire a director based on their resume and their experience and whatever they bring to the party. They will hire a writer. They will hire an actor. They will hire an art director, et cetera, et cetera. And they will hire a composer. They will not hire a music editor. A music editor is part of the composition team. So I have to ingratiate myself with composers and then hope mm-hmm. that they get the gig. When they get the gig, I get the gig. And as a matter of fact, that's one of the things. There are so many stories I have that we don't have time for about why I'm the luckiest music editor in show business to be on a single show for 32 years and 700 episodes. But one of them, amongst all the others, is the very fact that when we switched composers, Richard Gibbs was our first composer on The Simpsons for season one. And then we switched to Alf Clawson in season two. Well, like I just said, the music editor is part of the composer's deal. One of the questions whenever they hire a composer is, so who's your orchestrator? Who's your recording engineer? Who's your music editor? You know, who's your team that we're going to assemble? Alf Clawson could have very easily, you know, he just finished working for what, 6-7 seasons on Moonlighting. So whoever he had music edited, you know, at Moonlighting, he could have just as easily said, that's my guy. But he didn't. He was kind enough and gracious enough to say, well, he says, we haven't worked together, but you've got a 1-year head start on this show. You know the ups, the downs. Let's, you know, make it work. And we did for 27 years. So
that's great. Now, does the director usually handle his notes and everything just primarily with the composer and the film editor? Or are they coming into your office and giving technical notes also, especially about placement and timing and maybe breaking things up and so forth?
Well, obviously, everything is directed at the composer, but for the most part, it goes through the music editor because the music editor is kind of like the gatekeeper of all things technical. And my dog is squeaking the toy. Stop squeaking the toy. I'm talking. the notes go through the music editor because the composer wants to concentrate and keep their focus on the creative. They don't want to keep their focus on the technical. So a lot of that falls, you know, so notes and everything, yes, they go through the music editor to the composer so that then the composer gets what he or she needs and I am in the loop mm-hmm. so that everything, you know, is covered and works its way through.
That's great. That's a really good explanation.
So after 700 episodes
yep.
and all the seasons you've spent on the show, mm-hmm. how do you keep it fresh? How do you keep it something that's interesting to come back to,
right?
You know, episode after episode, year after year.
Well, for me, the one thing I've always recognized, and I have a great one-off story to give you the contrast. One of the things that is so wonderful about working on The Simpsons, apart from the people and the thing, right, is that it's a very funny comedy show. So I spend a good deal of my time laughing and in good spirits and in a good mood to be a part of the show. So that is invaluable to me. And my one-off story to contrast that was long ago, I got hired to do a pilot of a show. I can't even remember the name of it or if it even went, but I do remember Ving Rhames played the bad guy. And for television, and this wasn't HBO, this was, I think, going to go to NBC. He was a very bad guy in this show. And every story point pointed to him being taken down in the third act, but by the fourth act, he got away with it, and now he was going to be the central character moving forward. And I really didn't like this guy, and I didn't like the mood it made me feel because he was this bad guy. And fortunately, the show didn't get picked up. But I was thinking, I've thought about this many times over the years. I say, I have the option of either working on a show like The Simpsons, where I'm laughing and having a good time, and it's all silliness and craziness, or I could have had that feeling that I had in Act 4 of that pilot. Week after week, no, that was not pleasant. So,
can The Simpsons still surprise you after all this time?
Absolutely. Okay, so it's your timing to ask this question couldn't be any better. I don't know if you have seen the internet revolving around The Simpsons this week, but our executive producer Matt Selman is a genius in keeping the show in front of the public. On Sunday night, we aired an episode, and he posted on Twitter before the episode aired that the show was going to playfully reinterpret The Simpsons timeline by presenting Homer, a story with Homer as a teenager in the 90s. Now, the show has stated long ago that Homer and Marge were teenagers in the 70s, and that's when they met.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, also, Marge got pregnant before they got married, and Bart was born, I guess, in the early 80s or very like 79, who knows? But the point is right around there. So now what's happened with Homer being a teenager in the 90s is that Bart is older than Homer. So the fans who are very into the canon of the show, many of their heads exploded at the notion of that Homer can't be a teenager in the 90s. It's just not possible. To which Matt Selman preemptively, like I say, he wasn't responding to tweets. He proactively said this before the show aired. He said categorically, in his opinion, the show has no canon, that the timeline is elastic, that every episode is its own Groundhog Day, and that we are just telling stories with these characters. And each story has a beginning, middle, and end, and then you put it away. And that's the end of it.
Sure, why not?
Yeah, I had never thought of it this way. And having read that and then thinking about it, I said, this was genius of another level. Genius, just like I say, in terms of the publicity. Like I say, the just put Simpsons into Google and you'll see this week. It's just that's all anybody wants to talk about is Selman's tweets and the response to it. But more importantly, he has now, in my opinion, opened up 200 new stories that we could never tell if we had to religiously adhere to the canon.
Mm-hmm.
And he just categorically says there is no canon. Get over it.
That's a really brave statement.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I love it. I never thought of it before Sunday. And now that I've slept with it for 5 days or 4 days, I love the concept.
That's great. Let's turn back to all things Disney and Disney music.
All right.
Chris, working in the industry and with music and film and everything, what does Disney music represent to you? And what do you think Disney's legacy is in regards to the music in their films and their place in Hollywood history?
Well, you know, it's hard to talk about it in any terms that doesn't just sound overly, you know, just too flowery or too hyperbolic or whatever. But no, Disney throughout the years has absolutely set the standard. I think Walt Disney really understood how music really can help tell stories, can help push stories farther, can help an emotional beat in a way that nothing else can. And that being said, I will also say something that I have said about music myself, being a musician and a student of music and a practitioner and all these things. To me, music is the closest thing we have to actual magic. And again, that may sound like Fruit Loops kind of talk.
No, I get it.
But
get
it really is, because think about it. You can't see it. You can't touch it. You can't taste it. It moves in the air in a mysterious way that you can't. I mean, I guess with physics, we know about waves and so, but when you combine a violin and an oboe and a piano and a harp, you get a whole different thing than when you combine a trumpet with a timpani and a trombone. And the point is that when it all meshes just right and hits your ears just right, and you're in a particular mindset, you're moved to tears, you're moved to smile, you're moved to take a deep breath. It's amazing. You should check out the on Disney Plus. There's a 6 or 7 part documentary about the making of Frozen 2.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the episodes is about the creation of the song Into the Unknown. And when the producers and the director, Jennifer Lee, I think her name, right, hear that score with the live orchestra for the first time on the scoring stage, she's choked up. She can't breathe.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of anything else that has that effect. I mean, yes, theater can move you, a book can move you, but like I say, but those are things that have a tangible quality, other than the violinist bowing on the thing. But you know, like if you close your eyes, I think you wouldn't get as much input from a play or a movie. You can't close your eyes and read a book, I guess, unless you're reading Braille.
Mm-hmm.
But you can close your eyes, and the music can speak to you. And have this effect. It's like nothing else. So anyway, after that long pontification, I think Walt knew this very well and applied it, you know, to his films and really understood that.
Hey, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, it really can change the entire mood and everything.
So music is awesome. What makes a great song?
Oh, well, if we knew that,
right,
then, you know, I'd hang up on you right now and go write 10 of them. It's just like William Goldman said all those years ago about the movies in general. Nobody knows anything, right? There are, and if you go on YouTube, there are 100 different videos about, you know, so here's how a hook works and here's what really, but that's all deconstructing. That's all reverse engineering something to say, this is why it works. The question is, when you start with a blank palette, how do you make something work? There's no, you know, I think it's a combination of being brave and pushing boundaries. I mean, I'm a huge fan of the music of Stephen Sondheim. And if you listen to early Sondheim, it sounded like traditional Broadway of the 40s and 50s when he first started writing. When you listen to his early music, like the music for Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. But then you get into Sweeney Todd and Into the Woods, man, he went off on a whole different path. Well, that's the what I'm talking about, being brave to forge new kinds of things. And of course, there's a lot to be said. There's been study recently too about, you know, that repetition and hook, you know, one of my least favorite songs, but certainly one of the most popular, and it just hangs out, you know, is MC Hammer, Don't Touch This. But it's the same four notes. Okay, what I just sang you is the entire song, but he picked the right notes in the right order and the right rhythm, and it caught. You know, so that's why I say when you can't compare that to anything Sondheim ever wrote, yet they have equal strength and popularity with their respective audiences, right?
Yeah, that's well put.
You know, it's funny you say that. I took a class in college where a guy by the name of Nat Perrin was the producer or was the teacher. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he had done a whole bunch of different things. He said, I had a nice living in the Valley, working on Westerns at Warner Brothers. I went to work for the Addams Family. Vic Mizzi writes, and I'm living in Bel Air.
That's right. Yep. That was great.
Absolutely.
Everybody knows this, right? Everybody knows that.
So, Chris, were there any Disney films or songs when you were young that you deem as influential in steering you toward a career in music? Or were there any particular composers throughout the run of Disney movie songs?
That's a good question. Let me see. I mean, definitely. I mean, you know, I was very big into Mary Poppins. Mary Poppins came on when I was, what, six? Mary Poppins was 64. Yeah, so I was six years old. And we had the album, and, you know, and Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious is a great song. But I don't know that any of that pushed me towards my music. What pushed me towards my music career was Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass. I wanted to play the trumpet, so that was my instrument. I took up the trumpet in the third grade, and I wanted to lead the band like Herb did. So by the time I was in the sixth grade, I had my first conducting experience, and I led our school choir in the hit song of 1968/9, Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head.
That's nice. Awesome.
Hate to keep dragging us back to Disney, but that's kind of what the theme of the show is.
That's my fault.
Well, we will blame nobody but you. And side note on Herb Alpert, you guys wanted to maybe direct, lead the band. I wanted to take the photo of the girl on the whipped cream cover. That's just me, though.
the whipped cream cover. So good. So controversial for 1960, whatever that was.
Yeah.
Kirk and I mentioned earlier in the first part of the show that there are so many Disney movies that have multiple great songs in it, not just one trick ponies with that one marquee moment, one song.
Right.
Do you have a couple of those films that stand out to you, such as, you know, Lion King or Aladdin or Beauty and the Beast or Mary Poppins?
Sure. Well, and they're part of my list. So maybe we should start gravitating toward the list and we can do that. But I will say this, something occurred to me as I was compiling the list and doing the thing. So bear, you know, cut me off if I'm getting too windy here. But the American musical as we know it today started with Rodgers and Hammerstein with Carousel in the 40s. Mm-hmm. Okay. So some of the Disney music that is so well known predates this, and it treated it the same way. So Rodgers and Hammerstein were the first composers to do a musical on Broadway where the music was an integral part of the storytelling. You do musicals before that, it wasn't. It was story, story, stop, music, dance number, you know, for entertainment purposes that often had nothing to do with the story. It was just some thing to, and then story, story, and another musical number.
Right.
A great example is 42nd Street does that, and No, No, Nanette does that, and even Showboat to a certain degree, although Showboat started to show signs of that. But anyway, Rodgers and Hammerstein started to really integrate the songs into the story so that it all flowed like this. As I say, so Disney also was doing that. Like, for example, you know, the songs in Pinocchio, you know, there are like two songs in Pinocchio. They really don't do much to help the story per se. They're great songs, mm-hmm. but they're not story. So when did Disney really start storytelling, doing musical theater? Mm-hmm. It was with the animation renaissance with The Little Mermaid and Alan Menken and Howard Ashman. Mm-hmm.
We covered a lot of that ground in when we went over our lists. That's one of the things we both talked about, is that really it was Menken that came in after mm-hmm. that pairing that had done, I think it was Little Shop, and then they had come out and Disney hired him, and man, boom, 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 boom. And it's really evident, you know, that structure is present once you know how to look for it. For this theater illiterate guy, me, mm-hmm. I didn't recognize that until I started reading up when preparing for this show mm-hmm. and went, I'll be damned. That's exactly what happened.
Right.
There's at least three different Disney songs that have small, subtle borrows from, especially from the Little Shop soundtrack that you can find and you can place in there. But I think Menken and Ashman and Menken and Rice, and then the Sherman Brothers, obviously, those guys are the backbone of what has become Disney music, and others are carrying on the torch. But I think those two groupings are primarily responsible. Okay, well, let's do go to your list, because I think you kind of whetted our appetite and you teased a little there. So, Chris Ledesma, starting...
this is going to be interesting.
Starting with number 10, who makes your top 10?
Number 10, Go the Distance from Hercules.
Mm-hmm.
What I like about Go the Distance is it's a great combination of being the right style, of being it's a little bit of a pop song, but it's also got a nice... heroic feel, the chords in it. And the brass play it, and it's subtle. It's not overpowering, but it's subtle. And it's a really, really good, but I think underappreciated song.
Oh, it's a great song.
And that's Menken and I believe Tim Rice. And I think Tim Rice was doing lyrics on Hercules.
What's number 9?
Okay. Then number 9, Topsy Turvy from Hunchback.
Oh, I forgot about that.
The song, the whole movie opens, you know, with Quasimodo's, you know, desires, what's going to happen with his life. And then, of course, the big note is the Bells of Notre Dame. But this one sort of ray of light in an otherwise dark mm-hmm. movie was such a great feeling thing. It gave a good, and it was early in the movie, so I can't say it really gave you a break. It was like either the second or third song in the movie. But a great tour de force type of Broadway style number in the style of Be Our Guest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it had that same sort of, you know, right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that topsy turvy, and it's big, and that too. By the way, let me back up. You know, if you go listen to the Little Mermaid soundtrack, and I don't know, maybe I'm being a little snooty here about my being in my business. I know where they recorded Little Mermaid. It was recorded at a studio that doesn't really exist anymore. It's called Evergreen. It's on Magnolia in Burbank. And it was recorded with pretty much like only about a 35, maybe 40 piece orchestra, because this was their first foray into this. So they didn't pour a lot of money into it, right? And if you listen really carefully, if you got good tuned musical ears, you can hear not only the small orchestra, you can hear the small room, you can hear the reflections, the walls. It's not a big mm-hmm. place. Then suddenly you go on to Beauty and the Beast and The Hunchback of Notre Dame, and now the success had happened. And now we go to the 100-piece orchestra on a major stage in New York, and the difference is night and day. And Topsy Turvy is a great song to showcase, wow, that they threw money at this like nobody's business compared to Little Mermaid.
Right, yeah, good choice.
That's a great insight. Yeah. I love that. I love that.
What's your next?
All right, what's number 8?
You Ain't Never Had a Friend Like Me. Robin Williams, doing, you know, probably the one and only time you really got to cut loose and sing, you know, and get showcased. And again, for me, you know, so much of Aladdin had this Middle Eastern flavor to it. But again, I like that we just break out of there and here we go. It's another, it's a vaudeville number yeah. now.
But great, great song.
You know, it was just a total island of happiness in the otherwise Middle Eastern flavored score.
Cool.
A quick side note on that. I have had a friend who worked on that movie, and when they were getting ready to record that, people started piling into the observation booth to watch Robin work. And so much so that the Disney fire marshal had to show up and said, capacity is whatever it was, and said, you out, 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 out. And so, but they were just jamming it in there to see Robin.
That's awesome.
Okay. Number seven, another heartbreaking song. Easily is heartbreaking, but not so much. The placement in the movie and the lyrics did it, but not the tune so much. Remember Me from Coco.
Mm-hmm. One of the newer
Remember
entries.
Remember Me. Yep. Yeah. I think it had the same emotional impact as When Somebody Loved Me. And guess what? That's a Pixar movie, isn't it? Sorry.
That's okay. Yeah. Yeah, it is.
But
it's a good song.
That's okay. Guests get leeway.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but you know, it has that. If you've seen the movie, you know, they say, well, spoiler if they haven't seen the movie, but the point is they set this song up throughout the movie numerous times. And in it, it's a little ditty. It's a little thing. And then, so I won't give away the big story point for those who haven't seen it, but when the big turning point at the end of the movie or near the end of the movie comes and they sing this song in that context, breaks your heart, and in a good way.
Right, right. Well,
just fantastic.
Very cool. Great choice.
We won't count the Pixar thing on you because by that time the two had merged. So we'll call that Disney. What the heck? What's your next one?
Okay, very good. Well, that's true. That's true. Yeah. Okay. Well, I mentioned it earlier, and this is Disney, Into the Unknown from Frozen 2.
Mm-hmm.
I like it better than Let It Go. It's the same kind of feeling and attitude from the character, but more determined and more mysterious. And I love the integration of the Nordic sounds that Bobby Lopez and Kristen Lopez were able to mix into this thing. And like I say, go watch that episode on Disney Plus of the making of Frozen 2, and go, I think it's episode 3. It's either 2 or 3. It's all about the making of this song. And boy, is it exciting, at least for music nerds.
And another Oscar winner. What's your next one?
That's How You Know from Enchanted.
Oh, nice.
Another Menken great. And again, I didn't even realize this, but as I'm going through this and talking about it out loud, the thing I like about it is that it steps out of, so a lot of the music, the score and the songs of Enchanted were sort of send-ups of early Disney fairy princess movies.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had this Snow White Cinderella quality to them. But That's How You Know has a Latin sort of boom, bum, bum, ba, dum, bum, ba, dum, bum, da, dum, ba, dum, bum, ba, dum. Oh, and it comes out of nowhere. That it's got this entirely different feel. And Amy Adams, it was a revelation that she could sing like that. And
yeah, she was great.
And do this number. Yeah, really great.
Nice. All right, you're down to your top four. This is your Mount Rushmore. Who's number four?
There we go. A song. And I will admit, it's not just the song. It's the entire cinematic experience. I mean, I will listen to this song, but I will watch this song anytime, day or night, on a loop. Step in Time from Mary Poppins.
Great, great song.
Dick Van Dyke dancing his heart out. And the guy was already 40-some years old, I believe, when he did this. Unbelievable. And as a matter of fact, I don't know if many people noticed this, and they're gonna rag on me for this. I liked Mary Poppins Returns. I don't have any dislike of the movie, but I found that beat for beat, it felt like the same movie.
Mm-hmm.
And notice that there is this big dance number with the lamplighters
mm-hmm.
about two-thirds of the way, three-quarters of the way through the movie. I'm going, well, this is Step in Time. I mean, you know, and I love Mark Shaiman's music for the new one. Great, great songs and great, great tributing, sure. You know, to the Sherman Brothers. But Step in Time, oh, man.
Yeah, great.
It's great on every count. And not only that, like I say, I want to watch it. The dancing is great, the movement, the singing, everything. And they integrated, you know, animation with it as well. It was just fabulous.
How about number three?
Number three, Gaston from Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah. Yeah. Kirk and I were talking about that.
Yeah. The villain songs.
Yeah. I love Gaston from Beauty and the Beast.
I removed it from my list the night before. It was on my list. And then the night before I moved it out for something else.
But... yep. No, I love Gaston. I love in the original animated version. And I don't know if you ever saw the stage version, the Broadway version. The song is pretty much the same, but the choreography is greatly expanded. And mm-hmm. it's very fun and exciting. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, yeah. But what's nice about this being the villain song is it's a right. happy villain song.
Right, exactly, you know,
it's a happy villain song, and
it's a beer hall
it's
song.
Really, really fun.
All right, we're down to two. What's your number two?
Number two, one of the greatest "I Want" songs in the Disney repertoire of the musical thing, and I'll expand on that in a second. But anyway, Belle, the opening number from Beauty and the Beast,
beautiful song.
Beautiful song. And so since Kirk was studying up on his musical theater history, so the biggest thing in musical theater is the I Want, well, the two big things are the I Want song and the 11 o'clock song. But the I Want song is the main exposition. It's when the main character tells you exactly what they want. And it usually happens within the first three songs of any musical. In the case of Beauty and the Beast, it's in the first song. And often, you know, they even use the word want in it.
Mm-hmm.
I want adventure in the big wide somewhere, right? She says, that's what I want. Ariel says, I want to be where the fishes are.
Yep.
I want to. So the I Want song. This is one of the greatest I Want songs. And as I said, in not in just the context of the movie itself, but in the context of Disney's new ascension to the heights of animated musical theater, this was the follow-up to The Little Mermaid. So if you love The Little Mermaid and it set your hair on fire to wait, what was going to be next? And when you go to see Beauty and the Beast and this is the first thing you hear, mind bending and life changing.
I'm so glad you did some exposition on the I Want song, because Steve and I touched on that concept when we were exchanging our lists, and I did mm-hmm. a horrible job of describing what it was. So kids, listen to Chris. Don't listen to me.
Oh, you weren't that bad. You were fine.
I say, just put on your favorite cast album, and within the first three songs, the lead character is going to tell you what they want, what their goal of the musical is, and may very often actually use the words "I want" in the song.
That's right. All right, that brings us down to the penultimate movie in Chris Ledesma's list.
Yeah, and after all this, you got to go with the signature song, the one I think that represents Disney, but also it's so simple, it's perfect. It's When You Wish Upon a Star from Pinocchio.
Yeah, that's a clean sweep. All three of us agree.
That's the one, right? No, it's such a simple song. The chord progression is so simple and so straightforward. So then what makes it, I mean, if the chords are so simple and so almost unimaginative, then what makes the song? A fantastic melody, and the words fit just right. The word, you know, you need to study, you know, great lyricists, great lyrics, you know, study Oscar Hammerstein's lyrics to Roger's music, anything Sondheim. Sondheim wrote two books the size of telephone books about lyric writing and what it is. And that's what makes this song so perfect. The melody is just right, and the lyrics fit it perfectly, and the lyrics tell the story of I want to be a real boy.
Mm-hmm.
Without even saying those words in there. Without even saying anything about alluding to being a real boy, but that's what it's about.
And that's awesome. That is such a great description. Yeah. Such a great description. Yeah.
Well, that's a fantastic list. Really, really good choices, really good insight on them as well. Thank you for that. We expected nothing less from you.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks so much, Chris. This was awesome. Oh. This was absolutely terrific. Thank you.
You're very, very welcome. Thanks for asking me.
Before we let you go, though, just briefly, what's coming up next from you? And is there a way on social media that people can follow you if they chose to?
Sure.
And is it possibly Simpsons related?
Only slightly. okay. So on Twitter, I'm at MXEDTR. M like Mary, like music. MXEDTR. It's like a very smushed version of music editor.
MXEDTR.
So that's where you find me on Twitter. And my blog is called Simpsons Music 500. The web address is a little more convoluted than that, but if you just Google Simpsons Music 500, with or without the spaces, Google knows how to find me, mm-hmm. you'll find my blog. And the 500, interestingly enough, refers to the fact that I started writing the blog as we were coming into the approach pattern of 500 episodes.
Oh, nice.
But that's this Sunday, I'm not sure, when does this show hit the interwebs?
This coming up Saturday, so like in 2 days.
Oh, very good.
So like the 20th.
Well, then tomorrow, if this actually comes out on the 20th, tomorrow, the 21st, will be our 700th episode.
God, that's unbelievable. Fantastic. Congratulations. Yeah, it is amazing.
Yes.
That is terrific.
Yes. So you can go to the blog. I will be honest, I haven't posted a lot lately, even in the last couple years, because I think I'd covered it. You know, I wanted to cover my story, what I do on the show, how I work on the show, and then, of course, the approach to 500 episodes, and then mm-hmm. beyond. I went beyond. But in the last couple of years, you know, there's not a lot about just saying the same thing over and over and over. So more I've gone to mini microblogging on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Every now and again, I will throw up a post. I threw up a very clever Christmas post on my blog just this past December. So don't go there looking for a lot of new content, but there's a lot of content. There's easily like 100 posts there. It tells you a lot about the history of the music on the show, how I work on the show and everything. And people find it to be good. And they ask me questions about, you know, what was that piece of music in episode 75? And I take the time, I look it up. And you know.
That's great. Well, as Kirk said, we can't thank you enough for taking the time to be on the show. It's great to see you and catch up with you. It's always way too long in between visits, and so it's always good to see your face. Thank you for making the time for us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Thank
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. Thanks again. Stay safe, and I hope our paths cross soon.
Me too. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, that was awesome. Good to see Chris. Good to hear all his stories and his insights. The man is a wealth of knowledge for sure, and obviously very good at his job. He's been there doing it for a long time.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to talk with Chris. He is, as you said, a wealth of knowledge. He's engaging, explains things well. I always learn stuff when he talks about his profession and music in general. So it was good to have him on, and he had some great songs. Made me think about, you know, some of the Disney songs I really hadn't considered as strongly as some of the others.
Well, that brings us into our other regular segment, which is
The Populist.
The Populist. It's the chance where our listeners get a say in what's going on. They've gone onto our website at populistpodcast.net. They voted on their top 10 lists for the best Disney movie songs of all time. So the listeners have spoken, and they say at number 10, this is quite a bunch. There was a big tie here. They have A Spoonful of Sugar from Mary Poppins, A Friend Like Me, which was on Chris's list, Gaston, which also was on Chris's list, Someday My Prince Will Come, which was on yours, Hi Ho, Can You Feel the Love Tonight, and Kiss the Girl from Little Mermaid. Those are all tied for number 10. Number 9 also has a tie with How Far I'll Go from Moana, Hakuna Matata from The Lion King, Beauty and the Beast, Poor Unfortunate Souls from Little Mermaid, and Cruella de Vil. Number 8 all by itself was Colors of the Wind from Pocahontas. Number 7 was a small tie of Zippity Doodah from Song of the South, A Whole New World from Aladdin, Under the Sea from Little Mermaid, and I Want to Be Like You, King Louis song from The Jungle Book. Number 6, a tie between Be Our Guest, Chim Chim Cheree, and Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. So the two of the Mary Poppins songs tied there. Now, from 5 through 1, there's only one movie per slot. Number 5 was Lion King's Circle of Life. Number 4 was Frozen's Let It Go. Number 3 was Part of Your World from Little Mermaid. Number 2 was When You Wish Upon a Star by Pinocchio.
What?
Yep. Leaving number 1, The Bare Necessities from Jungle Book. It was close.
How many times did you vote?
I only voted once.
How many times did you vote?
I only voted once. Uno.
Uno.
Good job, listeners. As always, you brought your own take to the list. And even though we have a lot of ties, that always gets solved when more people vote. The more people vote, the less ties we have. So keep it up. We do appreciate your input.
Again, not a bad song on the list.
No.
I mean, these are all just great songs.
Yeah, like you and I said at the top of the show, you know, we could do a top 25 and have 25 great songs and still have a few left over that maybe could have, would have, should have been on the list. Well,
yeah, absolutely. A lot of fun. Good to speak with Chris. Nice to banter with you.
Yeah, as always. And next time on our next show, we will have the best stand-up comics of all time. If you go on to populistpodcast.net, that poll is already up. I think there's about 40 choices of some of the best male and female stand-up comics of all time. And just so people know, this is not the people that are just funny in movies. These are the stand-up comics, the ones who go to the clubs, go to the big theaters, and they got the mic in front of them or the mic in their hand, and they're doing their bit. They're doing their sets. So go vote on those, and we will talk about that next time. Check out stuff about our show on that website as well. You can find out a little about us, about past episodes. They're all there. And subscribe to the show, please, so it'll automatically be downloaded, and you won't miss any of the fun coming up.
And you can find all the episodes of Populist, both old and new, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon, Google, iHeartRadio, Pandora, or wherever you go to get your quality podcasts. Populist is a member of the Buzzsprout community, and we are a Vintage Year production.
We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/populistpodcast. You can follow us on Twitter at populist_pod or Instagram as populistpod. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. As we said before, we do appreciate you, each and every one of you. We love that you tune in and listen to our silliness. And you're a huge part of our ever-growing pod, and we hope to be doing this for a long time.
Thanks again, everybody. Please stay safe. Take care of yourself, Steve.
You too, Kirk. And look forward to our discussion on the stand-up comic. That should be a fun one as well.
Getting started on it now. Stay safe, everyone.
Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.